Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening in. Have you ever wondered what it's like to step on a landmine? Well, now we're getting ready to find out what it is. We got Michael Montoya, United States Marine Corps EOD on the line. He's going to tell us about when he was in Ukraine and what's going on from there. So get ready to take notes, strap in, we're going to have some fun.
This is EOD Gear Improvised.
EOD Gear Improvised.
Do we get to blow stuff up yet?
Stand by.
Everyone in EOD has a laser-calibrated eyeball. And plenty of attitude to go with it.
Seriously, can we blow stuff up now? Fire in the hole.
EOD-gear.com. Initial success or total failure. EOD Gear Improvised.
All right. Hey, I've had enough of the intro. So, Michael, thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, you know, we've stayed in touch. This is your third time on the show. Really grateful for having you on. And, you know, you had your incident back. Has it been a year yet?
Not until June 7th.
Okay. So that's going to be a big day. So we've stayed in touch, and then we ran into each other, you know, at Vegas at SHOT Show when we were exhibiting there. You came by the booth and you had your boot with you. So, it was great to see you. And then you were able to stop in here and we had a good time for a couple days here in Franklin, Tennessee. So, so now just for everybody, you know, I always like to ask, you know, where are you originally from? Where'd you grow up at?
A little town, it's got an old Air Force base, Goodfellow, San Angelo, Texas.
Okay. So was there a time where you were like, when you were a kid and go, man, I'm going to do something different. I remember, I think it was like in second or third grade, there was some Vietnam movie on and it showed this guy jump down into a hole to be a tunnel rat and he had his 1911. And I was like, you know, I was probably like nine and I'm like, man, that'd be so cool. Like, what is wrong with you? So, was there a moment when you look back and go, yeah, I'm going to do something different?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember it was in the second grade, Marine in his uniform came in to come see his elementary school teacher. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I want to do that and research it. And we kind of always played, you know, Army or, you know, military stuff through growing up and would go to the Army Navy surplus store. So yeah, that's kind of the turning point when I wanted to be a Marine was about the second grade.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So did you go right out of high school?
Yeah, I graduated early when I was 17 and went right into it. Had my birthday when I was in boot camp.
Nice. Yeah, I did too, but I was a little bit older. When I was 18, there's no way I was ready to have somebody tell me what to do. But so you ended up in EOD, and so where all were you stationed there?
Well, I did Okinawa, and then from there, you know, we did the 31st MU deployment to Iraq back in 2004-05, and where I became a lat moved and became a OJIT. In the 2300 field, so I could go to EOD school in 2005 after our deployment. And after I graduated there, I went to Yuma, Arizona at MCS Yuma and continued to do three more deployments from the wing station there.
Now, wasn't that the one where you told me where you showed up, but even before you had left school, you already had orders and were heading back over?
Yeah, so at the end of school, when I was in the last section in nukes, about 2 weeks before I graduated, I got a phone call. Someone walked into the classroom and was like, "Hey, Armand, boy, you got a phone call." And I was like, "Oh no, this can't be good." Getting pulled out of class.
Yeah, phone calls during EOD school are never good.
A family member, and you know, there's death in the family. I'm like, "Oh, who or what could have happened?" I got on the phone, you know, and answered, and Chief Warren was like, "Hey, you need to report to such and such. You're going over to Iraq." And I was like, "You realize I'm still in school?" He's like, "Oh yeah, yeah." Well, I mean, once you graduate, go directly to your unit, and you're going over to Iraq. You're a combat casualty replacement. I was like, "Okay." Walked right back into the classroom. Everyone's staring at me, and they're like, trying to figure out what family member died. And I was like, guys, I'm going back to war already. Wow. They're like, what? Yeah, so it got a little interesting.
Yeah, it gets real fast. So you check in and then you're gone. And so now you're back in Iraq. And then I guess you just got out. You didn't you didn't retire out.
No. Got out in April of 2010.
Smart people do smart things. You get out. No, it's good to stay, but yeah, that's sometimes it's just best to get out.
Yeah, to each their own. I mean, some people they got a certain thing they want to reach. And at that point in my life, I knew, okay, I'm done with this. I didn't like the way things were going. They didn't always like the way things were going with me, but that's okay. Everyone's up to their opinion. It was time for me to go and go do some contracting, working at, you know, different places throughout the United States and around the world.
Yeah. So can you talk about the time between getting out and the run up to you waking up one morning, I guess, and going, hey, I'm going to Ukraine.
Oh, you mean like getting out of the military or?
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, I got out back, like I said, back in 2010, immediately kind of worked out at the Yuma Proving Grounds out there and did that for about a year and a half, where I kind of moved up, you know, through their system pretty quickly. Was already spending so much time, 60 to 70 hours a week at work, plus, you know, a 45-minute drive each way to get there. And I was like, oh, I could make more money than this if I just go ahead and, you know, sacrifice all the time with the family while I'm overseas. So after that, in 2012, went over to work some of the counter-ID, EOD, and IDD contracts over in Afghanistan for about a year and 9 months, where I left that and did the human behavior pattern recognition analysis, the ASAT, Advanced Situational Awareness Training. And so I was a trainer in that for a while. And then in 2014, in October, shifted over to go do some training in Africa and kind of been there ever since, doing different training from, soldier skills training, counter-ID training, NCO training, like all the basic soldier skills. And that's when they came to me and another guy, Stuart Miller, and they're like, can y'all do an EOD course? And I was like, oh, absolutely. It'd be pretty easy because I'm EOD. And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, it's on my resume right there. I was like, oh, great. Okay, cool. So me and him, in a matter of a two-week period, got all the details and set up an EOD program for a 12-week period that kind of followed IMAS EOD standards up to a level 2 and IEDD basic. And it was only supposed to last for two cycles there in 2014. And then the program was still going when I left them in February of 2022. Wow. So it went from, you know, the State Department, if it was just appeasing someone, they came over there and saw what we were doing, saw how organized we are and how well they were doing, that they were like, can you guys keep doing this? And yeah, so we continue to do it up until 2022, and we pass it off to the people, the company we're working for, and they continued it. And I don't know if it's shut down since then or what's become of it, but I got to work with some really great Ugandans and still work all throughout Africa, from, you know, Benin, Zambia, you know, Chad, Niger, other places, plenty of places around there.
That's awesome. That's incredible. Yeah. So what was the turning point in you? Ukraine lights off, and that was, what's that been now?
Yeah.
It's 2 years ago?
Well, since the second real invasion, it's been just over 2 years. Last month, it was an unfortunate celebration, but still, you know, it's an anniversary of that main push that they did with the Russian forces and stuff in Ukraine. I mean, the stuff really started, you know, now a decade ago. So I've had very little chances to kind of help information wise and give some, you know, open source suggestions and stuff like that to help since the early invasion a decade ago. But once 2022 happened, I was sitting in a hotel just outside the embassy in Erbil, or the consulate, if you will, and, you know, watching the vehicles go over and watching everything going and just sitting there Just like if you get a chance to talk to Stu again, he'll tell you for about 3 days he didn't sleep at all and just turning in your gut and just going, you know what the right side of history looks like, and it was time to be part of the right side of history, regardless of political and other factors, and you know, us in the OD or myself and others, and even people who are in the military, we're protectors. We tend to help people, and we tend to, you know, fight for people. Yeah. And that's kind of that turning point. I did have to suspend the trip over there initially because I needed to, you know, make sure my family was still a family, because me being gone all the time almost drove a wedge between myself and my wife. But I sacrificed everything I want to do, came back to her. We worked on our family. And once we got to a point, she's like, I know this is eating you up. I want you to go do it.
That's incredible. It's a great story.
Absolutely.
So now you're in Ukraine, you're going to work. And, I mean, you know, what all were you doing there? Cause I know there's the front lines, and then, you know, I know it's very fluid at that point. And, I guess we'll eventually get to where the point last year, last June, but, just kind of like, what was your day like, you know,
that point? The biggest part is, we went over there under some, you know, organizations. And so we're initially kind of helping with the training, trying to set up the mine action side, which they didn't decide to go with, for a long permanent, basis, which then led us to, you know, form our own. But we were working with the police, working with the state emergency services of Ukraine, working with some of the sapper units, initially with some training. And how we do training, and what I've learned many, many times over the years, is when we go in and do training, we don't come in there with, hey, you've been doing it wrong, let me show you, you know, how to save the world. We go in there with eyes wide open, big ears and little mouth. We take a look at it because it's just another way. And so as we observe them, we say how they're, you know, working their toolbox. We, you know, compliment them on that. And then we show them a few additional tools they can use when and if they need it. Because, you know, the best mechanics have all the tools that they need. They don't always use them every day. And so that's what we wanted to do for them, is make sure they had all those additional tools when they needed them. And we're working that way until we got a MOU with one of the ministries, which allowed us to work kind of in the buffer zone and do emergency, like EOD tasks, and work with the police up until a certain point. So we could do a lot of the stuff, but the demolitions had to be handled by the authorities. So that's why we would turn stuff over or be on a joint operation where they did the demolition while we observed and were there to turn over all the items that have been located and, you know, collected.
Fantastic. Well, so, cause I remember you were moving up to, you said June 7th.
Yep. June 7th.
So I remember, so spring has sprung in Ukraine, and I think you had posted something. You weren't real happy with all the growth that was going on. So what was happening? What was happening that morning?
What, that morning of the incident?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of stuff. We're trying to organize stuff to get the authorities to come over and deal with this or deal with that. And some things, they've got a lot of stuff going on in Ukraine. So you're not always at the top of the list, or maybe it comes up and then you just got to go, get it done. So we were going and observing another location that a team had seen some stuff, but they didn't have all the necessary equipment or all the experience for the team that was working in another location. So we went and assisted, found a whole nother belt of anti-tank mines, did the initial marking and recording of what we found. And it was a mine strike with the tractor. And we went ahead and set up the initial, started to find, you know, the two lines of mines spaced about 5 meters apart, separated by, you know, a 2.5 meter offset, then 5 meters every single mine after that. And so we marked the first initial, like, 10 meter buffer to the left and right and forward. And then, you know, it was going to be a massive belt, probably, you know, 500 to 1,000 meters long, just by looking at the field. And that was just the first belt. And, you know, we got information that in front of it, there's another one. And then in the tree line, there was, you know, some Mon 50s and this and that. So that whole field and section was going to be an entire project on its own. And the problem with all those is we keep finding those entire projects day in, day out. So, yeah, we initially started with that. And then we returned to the field that we were going to do some stuff with the sapper unit.
Okay. So now, were these placed or dropped?
These were placed, but not all of them were buried. But the vegetation at this point, remember, you know, what do you call it? Ukraine is very, very good at growing things quickly. Yeah. So a lot of vegetation overgrowth and stuff. And so it takes time to kind of cut paths and do things. And so that's kind of the big major point there.
All right. So you're going along and you're working out in the field, or were you in the tree line?
No, I was maneuvering out through this field, kind of through the safe lanes. And, you know, it's just a slight little kind of stumble, stutter step, misstep slightly to the right. And it wasn't even a full foot off, foot length off the path, you know what I mean? So just right there, just off the path. And you don't notice the moment you step on a mine, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's kind of you figure it out over the next few moments.
So you were, because I remember I'd heard you got hurt and I texted you and you sent me that picture from the ambulance.
Oh, and yeah, with the stump all wrapped in bandages.
Yeah, yeah. So what was that? So you know, clearly you step on that and then, you know, it takes a moment to register. But I mean, what was that?
Yeah, I mean,
what was that feeling?
Yeah, so what it actually was, you know, like one moment, you know, I'm walking, next moment I realize I see blue sky and I see my knee. And so the first thought in my head, I remember, is, oh, I'm falling. So I just tucked my chin. That's all I did. And as I landed on the ground, you know, I'm there for who knows how long, half a second, full second, 3 seconds. But, I tucked my chin. I can see my knee. I go ahead and look between my legs, continue looking downward between my legs. I rotate my foot inward, and I see my toes are hanging, you know, on the inside of my foot. I go, take my right hand, and I remember just, like, waving it, you know, across my foot, you know, from a distance, obviously, but waving across. And I literally said to myself in my mind, going, okay, I'm an amputee. That's it. So whether it's, you know, because experience and because of training and because I've seen people go from, you know, injuries to recovery and anything and everything between, I just already had memories associated with this. So I knew what was going on. And at that moment, this is why I think like training is so important, is so you have some kind of memory to any situation you go to, even if it's not, even if it's a new memory, you have something close enough that's going to put you into what's happening. So, waved that off and was like, okay, I'm an amputee. And as I was sitting there with a big bang, my internal noise canceling headphones kind of kicked in. So I kind of heard, you know, tourniquet, tourniquet, tourniquet. Whether that was in my own head screaming it or, you know, someone else screaming it, that's what went through my head. And I rotated to the left, grabbed the tourniquet off my belt, and proceeded to open it and try to slip it over my my injury.
Gotcha. So you were there, and then now did you have anybody close proximity to you, or they came, you know, the crew came up?
Yeah, it was close proximity because, like I said, we're kind of within the safe lane. So it was, you know, a matter of 10, 15, 20 steps away, and they're on me. You know, by the time I got the tourniquet open in my hands, so that way I can just put it around my thigh, someone else had already gotten up to me, looped it over my my injury and tighten it down on my, just above the knee. And, you know, the messed up thing, you know, whether it's our training or whatever it can be, like after I just got the Velcro off and got it undone so I could wrap it around my leg, it just, the other tourniquet got applied. And so I remember in my head just dropping the tourniquet on my stomach and going, well, thanks, asshole. Like, I was kind of busy doing that, but, you know, I was thankful, but, you know, it's just, it's what went through my head. I can't forget it.
Yeah, I bet. Now, you had told me once you described it, it kind of felt like a sledgehammer hitting you.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, everyone thinks that, oh, you're going to be in immense pain. I mean, I wasn't screaming or yelling or doing anything like that. I was nice, calm, and collective. You know, I was talking to them, you know, they're doing the assessment, doing initial checks, you know, running their hands across my leg to see any other bleeding points. And of course, I'm like, okay, it's right there, ripping my pants open a little bit more. Okay, there's no, you know, blood coming out there. And then, you know, like I put my hand on one chest and I was like, hey, I'm okay. Everything's good. You know, tourniquet's on. I look back at Stu who's standing, you know, just over my shoulder to my side. And I, you know, put my hand up in the air, like a little fist bump. I was like, hey, fist bump. He taps my hand. I go, I'm good, dude. Bleeding's over. Everything's fine. I'm okay. And, you know, you ever see that I'm not okay, but I'm okay. Like initial life threatening things are done.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking, I'm coherent. I'm responsive, to the point, you know, I'm passing my phones to Stu, you know, but I dial the ambulance number to hand it to him, just to keep things going. And yeah, but the injury itself on a 1 to 10, it was about a 3.
Yeah.
You know, and I think most of it's because, you know, it's like getting hit in the nerves with a sledgehammer. And so therefore, all that stuff that's in pain is essentially numbed by the impact of the explosion. So there is some pain, but it wasn't like screaming and white knuckle, like grabbing stuff.
Well, I'm glad Stu was there, 'cause he's been on, you know, he's been on a couple of, you know, when you were on the other shows, he got a little word in there, but, yeah, I'm glad he was there with you.
No, so, absolutely.
So from there, I mean, it was, you were in Ukraine for a bit and then you left to, was it Germany?
Yeah, no. So I was in Ukraine, and from the side of the incident, it happened right around, I think, what was that time? It's either 12:30 or 1:30. I'll have to look at, I have the time stamps for where the calls were made. So I think it was actually 12:30 local time in Ukraine, when the incident happened. And then I was on the ambulance, and that's when I went ahead and called my wife to let her know that I was okay, as I was going to the hospital, and left her a video message. Then she called back and we talked, and I let her know everything's okay. I'm fine. You know, just like a 10-second message. Hey there. I love you. Stepped on a little landmine, missing part of my foot. Just call Stu and he'll let you know. So I still got the message off to send it to you, but, yeah. So my first trip was to Kharkiv, where I stayed in the hospital there, until the third morning, and I moved to Kyiv, and I stayed there for about 8 days in Kyiv, moved to Lviv for a night, and then moved on to Poland. I was in Poland until I went to a hospital in Germany. I arrived there on July 3rd. So it was about a 4-week adventure to get there.
Wow. So did you have, you had some complications there with infection?
Yeah. I mean, with all these blast injuries, and we saw it a lot whenever we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, anywhere else we've had blast injuries, is things kind of get kicked up into your body and embedded. And even though the debridements, and oh, by the way, the debridements were more painful than the actual injury itself, to the point, you know, 18 to 24 hours after those, that's where the pain was. You know, because they're sitting there taking a scrub brush to your flesh and your nerves that are open.
Ouch.
But, I was awake for a few of them, but numbed, you know, epidural and all that stuff. But when they hit a nerve, they saw me try to stand up out off the table. But yeah, we worked on all that stuff, and I had the complications of the infection that was in the bone, and went on antibiotics for 6 weeks, infusion. It was like two antibiotics they were using, one for three times a day for 3 hour infusion, and then one for four times a day at 3 hour infusion. So for a good most of the day, I was attached to IVs, in order to try to figure out if we got the infection out or not. I didn't have a lot of bone left down there on the foot. I kind of modified Chopard.
What was that?
I'm at like a modified Chopard. So if you go straight down your shin, I'm missing everything from your shin forward.
Gotcha. Okay. So you made it back to the States, and so now it's time to regroup. Now, what I thought was funny is when we were texting on the day this happened, you were saying like, oh yeah, as soon as I'm healed up, I'm going right back. And I was like, does your wife know this? So, but clearly she's cool with it. Mine's always like, don't you need to leave?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And all it comes down to is once I'm able footed on the prosthetic, I finally got it back after fine tuning it a few times, and I have it here with me. I just started on a regime of 30 minutes, three times a day to kind of get my body used to it, build up the calluses where it's rubbing, and then see if it's actually going to work or if we need to modify it further. But once I'm able footed and I can move around, within a high degree of certainty, then I can go back to doing what I do.
That's awesome. Well, I know you were getting around pretty good when in Vegas. I know you had your cart and you were here in Franklin. You were getting around all right. So
yeah,
I can't wait to see you back up on, with your prosthetic and being able to move around.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the little knee scooter gets me around just fine on pavement, but, getting out into the grass and stuff, you ain't going nowhere.
Yeah. That's a tough one. So now you have two things going on. You have your company, but now you also have your not-for-profit. Is that in the works? Are we there yet? Your official?
Yeah, so, no, absolutely. We got the other one started just before the incident, Wild Fields Group, and that's our for-profit, which we're going to be doing training and other things. And then since the event happened, we have set up that we're going to do a nonprofit to keep doing the stuff that we want to do, abroad. And that's the Invictus Global Response. And, it's Invictus, undying, unyielding, like never defeated. And then we're globally, we're not just going to do this in Ukraine, although that's where our first major project is happening, and we'll respond to any incident anywhere we could possibly help.
Well, rumor has it there's mines around the world.
I think there's something just about everywhere.
Yeah, just about everywhere. Yeah. It's nuts. It's out there. Cause we work with a lot of organizations and sending gear out to them. And it's amazing the amount that's going out. And of course, I was stationed in Europe for 7 years. And I remember at my village in Italy, I was getting ready to PCS out. And the landlord came up. He's like, hey, you're a clearance guy, right? And I was like, hey. He goes, well, there's a mortar up at the front gate. And the EOD, the Italian EOD guys were already out there. They had scooped it up. But it was an old World War II remnant left over, made its way finally back up to the surface.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's nuts how much is out there, and not just from recent, events, but yeah, global response. I mean, you're qualified. I mean, all over Africa and Eastern Europe and probably, everywhere else you've been. So yeah, you're definitely qualified to have global in your title.
No, absolutely. And we've been many, many, many countries and done stuff, especially, while working under other companies. But essentially now it's time to get to be our own company. It's time to do the stuff that we're doing for others, to be the leadership, to be the company, that is out there to find to find the qualified people who are knowledgeable and experienced and get them to the places that need it.
That's awesome. So for, you know, so how does somebody, whether they're maybe an individual that wants to work with you, or maybe they're a prime contractor who, you know, they have their place, they have all the large contracts, but they're always looking for subcontractors. How do we get a hold of you for Invictus Global Response? And then, you know, just from that. So who's your ideal customer, and how do they get a hold of you?
No, absolutely. Anyone who's requiring training is an ideal customer. You know, training or operations or management, or needs to get established somewhere, because we have so many contacts everywhere we've been.
So the training, now, do you want to do training here at CONUS, or are you going to do mainly OCONUS?
No, we're going to do both. So we're looking at setting up a training school here in the U.S. to train EOD, whether it's the IMAS standards or UXO tech. It's all stuff that we're in the works. We're small, we're little, but we're going to start growing. And we'll also do and facilitate other types of training, as it deals a lot with counter ID or any explosive hazards, to include, you know, sponsoring some courses or doing some courses that incorporate blast injury type training or medical training on the lower level. So we're not training doctors here, but, you know, to keep someone stable, some kind of
Emergency procedure stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
That's it.
First in. Yeah.
And you can use it literally anywhere in the world. Use it in a minefield. You can use it, you know, at your house. If someone falls or cuts themselves or whatever may happen, you come across an accident, someone gets hit by a car in front of you. Just the basic stuff that could save someone's life is ideal. And we'll be able to provide that, but with a heavy focus, especially on the explosive or the, you know, the military or security aspects of the world. So, and as we grow, we're not going to just do just EOD. We're going to grow into it, physical security and everything else.
That's incredible. So what is the website? I know it's Invictus Global Response, but,
So we got two of them, and the for-profit and stuff, of course, is the Wild Fields Group. That's WILDFIELDSGROUP, and that's .com. And that's where we got our SAMs. We're going to start going after some government contracts to basically help sustain our livelihoods and get veterans and get other people into it and get people work. And then our not-for-profit, our NGO, where we're currently on project, you know, Stu and the guys are out there in Ukraine right now as we speak, is the InvictusGlobalResponse.org. And so, you know, we got three pillars with that organization that we're mainly focused on, which is mine action and everything that encompasses that. We're also doing humanitarian aid. So, you know, not just the mine action, but what happens afterwards, or how do we keep the people sustained and there, whether it's building or setting up a kitchen, and managing all this stuff. And then, of course, capacity building. How do we get people to be able to help and assist themselves for a long-term duration? And so one of the biggest things we do that we're going to focus on is also the management and collaboration of different organizations and agencies. You know, not one organization can do it all. So, and the people who are trying to hoard something, or they're trying to like just we're the only game in town.
Yeah,
they're not actually really doing anything other than holding on to it and keeping other people at bay, and therefore, you know, maybe a detriment to the actual community. We want to fill the gaps. We want to identify every problem and then be the solution to bring everyone in and going, we can't do this, but we know you three organizations can. Which one wants to come in here and help with this? Okay, we can do this, so we're going to start doing this. We can't do these other three things, but we know you guys can. Let's come together. And then the biggest thing is, we don't want to just, what's the old saying, give someone a fish, feed them for a day, teach them a fish, feed them for a lifetime. We don't want to just be the people that give fish. We want to we're going to empower the community to take care of themselves. But that might be a requirement of resources being brought in, a certain training to retrain a mechanic in the town so that way they can fix tractors and generators and vehicles, you know, a tool set for the mechanic that lost all their stuff, whatever may, whatever's required, but it's to empower the communities that we're in.
That's incredible. So what are your, what do you have some, you know, I know Stu's over there. Stu, if you're listening, I want to get you on the show too. So just go ahead and set your calendar. Let me know. What do you guys need right now? I know Stu's over there, so, like, you know, wave your magic wand. Everybody who's listening, maybe you have something laying around you're not using. What do you need?
No, absolutely. It's a multitude of things, but one of the biggest things we're doing right now is generating funds so that way we can sustain the team and the projects going. Right now, most of it's self-funded by the team and ourselves paying for it. We started getting donations in. One of the biggest items, two items really, that we're trying to get donations for is a vehicle to be able to get the team around so they can go do their assessments, do some of the training that they've already been asked to conduct. And then the other requirements we're doing is ambulances, whether it's one or two, in order to get, it's part of the accreditation process to do humanitarian mine action under the IMAS standard there in Ukraine. So it's one of those requirements we got to get. We're doing it a little bit extra beyond is when we get additional stuff and identify those things, we're going to be supporting the community we're in as well. So not only are we supporting the team whenever they're conducting stuff in an area, but when we're not conducting stuff in an area, the team is available and ready to support the local community for whatever they may need. So that's why, that's our biggest push. Other things, of course, funds, and then other items that we identify as we continue to grow and as we continue to progress. Right now, we're just a small team, but we're going to grow. And our main focus is to actually grow within the communities and bring in the specialists as required and to capacity build to get the community to continue to grow upon itself and protect itself and help itself.
Man, that's great. What a great mission. So really proud of you, man, for taking the hit and getting right back up and getting back after it. That's been cool. So hey, we'll wrap it up, but like what's the last word? What do you got?
Oh, last word. Best thing to say is, I mean, we're in it to win it. We're going to do great things, and currently it's one of the most humbling things I've had to learn over the last year is how to ask for help. That's what I'm doing is we got to start somewhere, and I'm asking for anyone, everyone's help in order to help us get to a position that we are affecting the greatest impact and change and supporting of communities worldwide. Starting, of course, with our project there in Ukraine. So if you got old equipment, you got old medical stuff or stuff that's just meant for training, get a hold of us at the InvictusGlobalResponse.org. We'll get you an address and get it over to us, and we'll start putting it to use. If it's something you're never going to use or something you don't care for anymore, we'll take it. We'll find some use for it. Even if we don't use it, we probably know someone who needs it. And we'll get it to that end user that's going to be the most impact and change. But financial support, equipment support, well wishes, follow us on our social media, which you can find on our website.
Yeah, you guys are really strong on Instagram. So I don't, you know, we post to Facebook, but I'm rarely on it. So are you guys, what all socials are you on?
Yeah, no, we are on, go buddy, go. Hold on, buddy. We are on LinkedIn, we're on Instagram, and of course, we're on X, formerly known as Twitter.
Gotcha. All right, everybody. So, yeah, let's go ahead and check out wildfieldgroup.com and InvictusGlobalResponse.org. Send Michael a message. Let him know, you know, what you can do to help, and or at least a word of encouragement. And get out there. But all right, Michael, I interrupted you. What one more thing you got?
I was just going to add in there. You know, even if you can't help, spread the word. That's the biggest thing. A great man told me recently, you know, it's not the 100 people you know, it's the 100 people that those 100 people know and beyond. So
that's it.
Let's get the word out there and let's do great things.
Sounds great. Michael, thank you so much, and look forward to having you back on again.
I appreciate it. I'll talk to you and see you soon.
You've been listening to EOD Gear Improvised.
EOD Gear Improvised.
Steve Cassidy, a former Navy EOD tech and owner of EOD Gear Initial Success or Total Failure. Two locations, one in Franklin and one in Huntsville. The website is eod-gear.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Twitter. EOD Gear has customers from around the globe. Until next time, this is EOD Gear Improvised.
Signing off.